Springer versus Bennick, Mr. Cortez.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jordan Cortez, and I, along with Mark Emery, represent the petitioner, James Springer. We are from the University of Notre Dame Law School, and our supervising attorney is Bob Palmer. Pursuant to this court's order, I will be arguing the main argument. Mark Emery will be arguing the rebuttal. In the Certificate of Appealability, this court certified two issues for the parties to address on appeal. First, ineffective assistance of counsel, and second, a statute of limitations claim. I first would like to address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. After the court-appointed public defender Charles Vetzner met with Springer for his one and only face-to-face meeting for approximately 10 minutes, Springer expressed a desire to pursue certain matters on appeal. At that point, under Wisconsin law, Vetzner had two choices. One, to pursue an appeal on Springer's behalf, or two, to file a no-merit brief. Vetzner did neither. Vetzner instead received a sentence credit on behalf of Springer for approximately 2 months out of a 40-year sentence. And two, he transferred all the transcripts and record to Springer, after of which he closed the case. Once, after Springer was initially convicted, he did file a timely notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief, and that is when Charles Vetzner was appointed to represent Springer. From that time until the time he closed the case, there was never a no-merit brief filed, nor was there any direct appeal on Mr. Springer's behalf. Vetzner essentially left Springer in the dark, not knowing that his appeal would not take place, and thus, under the Strickland test, pursuant to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in that case, we argue that counsel's representation was deficient because it did indeed fall below an objective standard of reasonableness, and two, that we argue that his deficient performance was prejudiced Springer in that Charles Vetzner abandoned Springer in pursuing his direct appeal rights. Essentially, Springer did not have any attorney to represent him in his direct review and to pursue his appellate right. Also, this court in Castellanos v. United States has held that when counsel's performance may be considered abandonment, where the defendant never received the benefit of a lawyer's services in constructing potential appellate arguments, and when no one had looked at the record with an advocate's eye, we believe that this is exactly what happened in the case with Springer. And when abandonment of counsel is found, prejudice is presumed, and no showing is necessary. The second issue that was certified by this court is the issue of the statute of limitations under Section 28 U.S.C. Section 2244D1A, which states that the statute of limitations for federal habeas begins to run within 1 year after the end of direct review or for the time for seeking such review. In this case, we believe that the time that direct review ended for Mr. Springer was when the Wisconsin Supreme Court rejected his reinstatement of direct review rights, not when the trial court entered a conviction. And with regard to the statute of limitations claim, I'd like to make four primary points. First, when direct review ends for Section 2244D purposes is a matter of state law. Two, at the time, Wisconsin law allowed Springer to do exactly what he did, under Wisconsin statute section 809.82, an appellate court, upon showing of good cause, may enlarge or reduce the time prescribed for filing an appeal. Mr. Springer, in his brief to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, filed it under this applicable section of the Wisconsin statutes. Three, that other federal circuit courts have recognized that when a prisoner avails himself or herself of a state procedural mechanism that permits reinstatement of direct review rights, where ineffective assistance of counsel is shown, direct review has not concluded for section 2244D purposes. And fourth, Springer timely filed within the one-year statute after the Wisconsin Supreme Court closed the issue of direct review by denying Springer's petition for reinstatement of his direct review rights. Specifically, Springer filed 8 months after the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision. Under the state, the specific...
Maybe you want to save some time for rebuttal.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cortez. Mr. O'Neill?
May it please the court. My name is Aaron O'Neill. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin, and I appear on behalf of the respondent appellee in this matter, Warden Daniel Benick. It's the state's position that this court only needs to determine whether Mr. Springer's petition for a writ of habeas corpus should be considered timely filed, either under the statute of limitations for habeas corpus petitions filed by state prisoners or under the doctrine of equitable tolling. Because Mr. Springer has failed to demonstrate that his petition should be considered timely under either theory, this court should affirm the district court's order dismissing his petition. In terms of the statute of limitations, it appears that the parties really only disagree on one thing, and that is when Mr. Springer's direct review of his state conviction ended, and thus the statute of limitations began running. As I explained in my brief, Mr. Springer began but did not complete proceedings under Section 809.30 of the Wisconsin statutes, which governs direct review of criminal convictions in that state. As a result, when he failed to take the next available step under those procedures, his time for filing his habeas petition began to run. And as I explained, that's not exactly clear under Wisconsin law when that was. It was either on July 1st or July 14th, 1997. But in this case, it really doesn't matter which date you use, because Mr. Springer's petition or filing period would have expired in July 1998, unless he can show he had something pending in state court between July 1997 and July 1998 that would have statutorily told the statute of limitations. Mr. Springer had no such post-conviction motion or collateral attack pending, and his petition was not filed. His habeas petition was not filed until December 2003. As a result, it was untimely by more than 5 years. Mr. Springer's position is that his petition was timely under the statute of limitations because his motion to reinstate his appeal rights was actually part of direct review under Wisconsin law. I urge this court to reject that position. Mr. Springer really hasn't demonstrated that Wisconsin courts treat kind of motion that he filed, a motion to reinstate his direct appeal rights, as part of the actual direct review process. And he can't demonstrate that even in his particular case, that's how the state courts treated it. First, I guess by definition, a motion to reinstate direct appeal has to be considered outside of the direct appeal process. He asked the court to essentially reinstate the time for taking his appeal, but this was long after his time for taking a direct appeal and complying with the applicable appellate rules expired. Mr. Springer tries to frame his motion in state court really as a motion for an extension of time, but the general appellate extension of time statute allows two kinds of motions. One, you can file before the time for doing something has expired, and two, you can after the time has expired, you can request the court allow you to file essentially a late whatever deadline you missed. Mr. Springer requested that his repeal rights be reinstated after it had undoubtedly expired, and he really cannot, his motion to reinstate his appeal cannot be considered part of the direct review process in Wisconsin. This position, the state's position, is actually consistent with the cases from the Tenth Circuit that Mr. Springer cited, Orange versus Calbone. There, the Oklahoma Court of Appeals, or the Oklahoma courts, have a specific procedure allowing defendants who have missed the time for taking the review of their petition, or excuse me, review of their conviction on direct appeal, to file a motion to take an appeal out of time. While the statute in Oklahoma appears to be a little more clear-cut on what's allowed than under the Wisconsin procedures, the fact is that, well, what the Tenth Circuit said in Orange is that when the court allows an appeal out of time, then whatever proceedings come next are considered direct review under the state law. It's not so much the motion that restarts the appeal time, but it's whether the court actually allows the motion to restart the appeal. In this case, had the Wisconsin Court of Appeals granted Mr. Springer's motion to reinstate his appeal rights, he would have received a new habeas filing period after he completed whatever direct appeal he took pursuant to the Court of Appeals motion. But because he didn't, or because the Court of Appeals did not reinstate his appeal rights, his habeas filing period expired in July 1998. Adopting Mr. Springer's petition would really allow any Wisconsin prisoner to circumvent the habeas filing statute by simply filing a motion to reinstate his direct appeal for whatever reason and any time after either he's had a direct review or, in this case, where Mr. Springer did not have an appeal. This would completely undermine the state's interest in the finality of its criminal convictions, and which the habeas statute of limitations was really imposed to implemented by Congress to protect. As for Mr. Springer's equitable tolling claim, the recent decision of the United States Supreme Court in Pace, which I submitted last week in a Rule 28J letter to this court and Mr. Springer's attorneys, the court addressed equitable tolling in the context of a state habeas petition, and the court said, assuming that equitable tolling applies to habeas proceedings, then a prisoner has the burden, who's trying to take advantage of equitable tolling, has the obligation to make two showings. One, he has to show that he was diligent in pursuing his legal rights, and two, he has to show that extraordinary circumstances stood in the way of his filing. I don't think Mr. Springer really can make either of these showings. In terms of diligence, this case is quite similar to the factual situation in Pace, where
I don't understand that test. I don't understand requiring diligence and extraordinary circumstances. If he's diligent, but he didn't succeed in filing within the statutory period, he must have been blocked by something.
I think I agree with your assessment of the two-part test. It doesn't fit neatly into... it's hard to separate those two factors. And I think then what this really boils down to is Mr. Springer has to show that there was some extraordinary circumstance in his way.
No. He has to show that he was diligent. If he was diligent and he didn't succeed, then yes, he was blocked. If there was an extraordinary, I suppose it's an either or.
Yeah, that's the way I read it.
Circumstances. So even if he had been diligent, he wouldn't have been.
Well,
that's enough. But anyway, what's his problem? He wasn't diligent?
He wasn't diligent because he waited an unreasonable amount of time before pursuing his claims in state court. He waited essentially 5 years before he requested the state courts reinstate his direct appeal rights. After the conclusion of those proceedings, he again waited another 7 months before filing his federal habeas petition. In Pace, the Supreme Court said that was... And under similar circumstances, the petitioner had not been diligent in pursuing his claims. As perhaps an excuse to why he didn't act diligently, Mr. Springer points to, he claims he has a learning disability, but he really hasn't made any specific connection between this disability and his inability to exercise his legal rights at any time before he began pursuing this claim either in state or federal court. And I would suggest that the record actually refutes his claim that he was incapable of exercising his legal rights any time before he began pursuing his abandonment of counsel claim. In his meeting with Attorney Betzner in June 1997, Mr. Springer contends that he suggested several legal claims that he thought should be pursued on appeal. This raises at least the inference that Mr. Springer was aware that he had some legal rights and he thought they had been violated. The record also shows that Mr. Springer filed two sentence credit motions in state trial court in 2001 and 2002, which Mr. Springer claims that he was unable to file any legal filings on his own behalf and that he had to ask for help from other people. But the fact that he filed sentence credit motions in 2001 and 2002 before pursuing his abandonment claim shows that he was at least capable of asking others for help before he began pursuing this claim. So I would ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Emery?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The state's position puts a prisoner who seeks a direct appeal in it to it forces them to take a nonsensical position. In Springer's case, he sought reinstatement of direct appeal rights, but according to the state, there was no way that he could have them again. But the state of Wisconsin had provided, under its law, an opportunity to seek reinstatement of those direct appeal rights. So it's impossible for a prisoner to be able to have both. We believe that where a state provides a procedural mechanism to revive direct appeal rights where there's an allegation or showing of ineffective assistance of counsel, that the direct appeal process or direct review for purposes of 2244D1A does not come to an end until the highest court has ruled that there's no longer direct review available under state law. We emphasize that the heart of this appeal lies in 2244D1A, and it's not necessary.
Well, on this tolling issue, I don't understand how learning and disability could ever be a basis for tolling.
We don't think that
most of them probably, most prisoners probably have a learning disability or some equivalent intellectual handicap of some sort, illiteracy, no education, what have you.
Your Honor, it may
not. The whole thing would dissolve, right? There'd be no more debt. If we were realistic about the abilities of prisoners to write briefs and so on, then there wouldn't be any deadlines.
Your Honor, in this case, Springer's dyslexia is only one component of what of the obstacles that stood in his way to reinstating his direct appeal rights. The dyslexia is a severe impairment. Beyond this, though, he suffered significantly from the abandonment of his counsel at the appellate process. At no point did Springer ever have an appellate counsel that sat down with him and simply explained, these are the appellate arguments that you should consider making. This is what's available.
Didn't his appellate counsel get him some sentencing concession?
Pardon me?
Didn't his appellate counsel get him some sentencing concession?
They did, Your Honor, but in no way would it be reasonable for Springer to consider this a trade. I mean, he received, I believe, 80 days of sentence credit, and there's no way that he would simply trade the sentence credit for loss of all of his appeal rights. So it doesn't seem...
It doesn't exactly sound like abandonment, though, when you... Post-sentencing, your appellate, your counsel gets you some credit on your sentence.
But as the federal habeas petition notes, Mr. Springer has several important claims that have, to this point, have still gone unaddressed by any appellate court, including that there was alterations to his plea agreement, that there were misleading statements made to the jury, that there might have been some improper influence. He's never yet had any opportunity to present these arguments to any appellate counsel. We believe that since Mr. Springer's direct review had never come to an end until April 22nd of 2003, when the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that his that he no longer had direct review, that 2244D1A does govern in this case, and it's not necessary to reach the equitable tolling argument. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Amory. And thank you to Notre Dame for taking on the case. Okay, move on to our last argument.